From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
North Oakland.
Temescal.
Alamo Square.
I live in Noe Valley.
Corona Heights.
Western Addition.
I live in North Oakland, right by MacArthur BART Station.
Coming up, we see how San Francisco's investment in a new HIV prevention treatment could change lives for the better.
PrEP is a relatively expensive intervention, but living with HIV is also an expensive proposition.
Then we hear about an investigation into organ trading.
If you talk about black market in organs, you erase the people who are being trafficked.
And we visit Highland Hospital in Oakland to hear from a healthcare professional who treats the spirit.
It's not the medical treatment, it's the human treatment that should be first and foremost.
Body and soul, today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Today is World AIDS Day. This morning, about 200 people gathered at the National AIDS Memorial Grove in Golden Gate Park. They read the names of people who've died from the disease in the past year. They also gave honors to people who've worked in the struggle against AIDS, like Paul Boneberg, the executive director of San Francisco's GLBT Historical Society. Boneberg remembers the struggles he experienced in trying to convince authorities to care in the early days of AIDS.
It's in many places the same response, where individual people tried to get governments that could care less to react. And there's just countless examples of individual heroism and sacrifice to try to change the course of the pandemic.
An estimated 39 million people have died of AIDS since 1981, according to the World Health Organization. 1.5 million people died last year alone, but better treatment options have allowed many to live with the disease. For decades, San Francisco has been offering free condoms, STD testing, and counseling to its residents to help end the HIV epidemic. These interventions have had a big impact over the years, but the city still saw about 350 new HIV infections last year. And nationally,
there are about 50,000 new infections that happen every year.
That's Susan Phillip from the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
So we know that we need more tools in the arsenal.
And one of those tools, Phillip says, is something called PrEP. It stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it's a new way to prevent HIV infections using a drug called Truvada. Truvada has been used for more than a decade to treat HIV, but since 2012, the drug has been approved for a new purpose, HIV prevention. Taken daily, Truvada has been shown to be over 90% effective at reducing the risk of HIV infection. Last month, the city's Board of Supervisors allocated $300,000 to help San Franciscans who want PrEP to get access to it. But many people haven't even heard of it.
PrEP. I have not heard of PrEP before.
PrEP? No. I mean, no.
I've heard of the word. I don't think I know what you're referring to specifically.
Sounds interesting. Sounds beneficial.
Those were voices of people in the Castro District on a recent Saturday. And while not everyone knows what it is, PrEP is already changing lives and the way gay men make decisions about their sexual health. KALW's Daniel Moore has the story.
Andre Sanchez is a 26-year-old gay man who lives in the East Bay. He's vocal about being on PrEP. He says PrEP has changed his sex life.
I used to be known as the condom queen because I was always preaching, like, you need to have safe sex, you need to have protected sex, you need to be informed, talk to your partners. But PrEP has let me be a little bit more liberal.
Sanchez identifies as African-American and Latino. And as a man of color, he has a particularly high risk of contracting HIV. So he's participating in a research study that makes PrEP available for free to men of color like himself. Sanjay says he still talks with his partners about their HIV status and when they last got tested. But being on PrEP helps him feel like he has an added layer of protection.
Because there's the what if. What if the condom breaks? What if I get drunk at a party and I decide to have sex, but there's no other form of protection around.
Men like Sanjay, who have multiple sex partners, aren't the only ones benefiting from PrEP. Monogamous couples are using it too. Anthony Lucas is HIV positive. His partner is negative and on PrEP. Here's Lucas.
For a really long time, I was starting to think that like condomless sex was like this privilege that only heterosexual couples got to have. And I felt kind of robbed of that, and I kind of felt like a monster because I was positive.
Lucas says PrEP has changed not just their sex life, but the intimacy between them too.
I can't imagine my like sex life or emotional or spiritual life being anything other than what it is now as a result of like this one minor thing, which is that I know I'm not going to infect him, and like I know that we're both okay, I guess.
And it's not just for gay men. PrEP can work for other people at risk for HIV, like sex workers, IV drug users, or anyone with an HIV-positive partner. All told, the Center for Disease Control estimates that over 400,000 people in the United States would benefit from PrEP, yet very few people are being treated. That's true here in San Francisco, too.
When you look at PrEP and the potential that it has, I think it's really surprising that only a few people have actually had access to it.
That's San Francisco supervisor David Campos. He says cost is one of the biggest hurdles to improving access to PrEP. Without insurance, Truvada, the medication used for PrEP, costs about $1,200 a month or over $14,000 a year. Most insurance companies will pay for PrEP, but not all of it. That means some patients are stuck with unaffordable copays and deductibles.
I also think that it's important for Gilead to do more than what they're doing.
Campos is referring to the drug manufacturer Gilead. It sells Truvada to low-income countries for a fraction of the U.S. price, less than $30 a month. And though Gilead does offer some assistance for patients in the U.S., Campos thinks they could do more.
You know, we're still in conversations with them, but I would hope that that more could be done by the manufacturer to help people.
But even at its full cost of $14,000 a year, the price tag for PrEP may be worth it, according to Susan Phillip from the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
PrEP is a relatively expensive intervention, but living with HIV is also an expensive proposition.
In fact, the estimated cost of treating one HIV infection over a lifetime can be more than $500,000.
There's also, you know, the human cost. You have to think about the life years affected by people. These are often relatively young people, healthy, who then go on to have to manage a chronic disease for the rest of their life.
Anthony Lucas and his HIV-negative partner have noticed some surprising benefits to going on PrEP. Here's Lucas's partner, Esteban Cuaya Munoz.
It actually made me think about more about my health, taking care of myself, eating healthy. I've also stopped drinking alcohol, and part of the reason is because I'm also on Truvada, but I want to take care of my body as best I can.
Yeah, I'm just one of the things I noticed in Esteban is that he takes better care of himself as a result of being on PrEP.
For Lucas and Cuaya Munoz, the benefits of PrEP are clear, and so are the risk factors. Lucas knows his status, is proactive about his health, and wants to protect his partner. But for many other sexually active people, there are a lot more unknowns.
I am at risk. I don't know quite, I can't quite quantify, which I would have loved to when I was deciding to go on PrEP.
One medical student who wished to remain anonymous put it this way.
I would have loved to have like a solid number, like a formula. I could like plug it, like I could plug in what are my exposures, like how many partners do I have, like what types of sex I have with the partners. I just would have loved to have that formula that like spits out a number.
That formula doesn't exist. But for many, PrEP is a powerful option in the fight against HIV and AIDS. And yet few people are on it. So after more than 30 years, the end of the epidemic may still be out of reach. For Cross Currents, I am Daniel Moore.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. More than 120,000 people in the United States are in line waiting for an organ transplant. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, another name is added to the list every 10 minutes. While health professionals attempt to come to grips with the increasing demand for life-saving transplants, Nancy Shepper-Hughes has been investigating the dark consequences of this demand, the global black market in human organs. She's been exploring it for more than two decades. Shepper-Hughes has conducted investigations in Turkey, shared information with the FBI, and spoken to living transplant donors from India to South Africa. But she isn't an FBI agent or a police detective or even an investigative journalist. She's an anthropologist. Critics say she's more activist than scientist, but others applaud her for bringing relevance to a discipline long known for sitting on the sidelines. Nancy Shepper-Hughes sat down with Holly Kernan to discuss her investigation.
Can you quickly explain how it actually works, how this black market operates?
The most egregious kind of international networks that operate will have brokers that work for them. Sometimes they're surgeons themselves. Sometimes they work with brokers who have PhDs in pharmacology or PhDs in some aspect of biology that are linked. So it's a very, very high-scale trafficking deal where at the very top you have professionals, and then at the very, very bottom you have what I call kidney hunters, often people who had sold a kidney and then are used by the network to find other people, you know, who might be willing to sell the kidneys. So what you would have is, you know, one country sending, being a sending country. It could be the United States. It could be Turkey, which has done everything, both being a sender country and a recipient country. I followed a very large Israeli network. It was by accident, but it was very extensive, and it involved countries and surgeons and doctors from the Philippines and China all the way through Brazil, South Africa, Moldova, Turkey, wherever people could set up a place to have a clandestine transplant in a reasonably decent hospital. You have, so that there would be a country where the people come from, there would be a country where the operation takes place, and then there might be another country, and there usually was, where the sellers come from. So it makes it a very in-and-out operation. That is, basically, the people arrive, they have their surgeries, and they go home again. And what happens to them afterwards is anybody's guess, but we tried to make it not anybody's guess, but to actually follow the lives of several hundred people who traveled, and with some exceptions, they know that they're going to be going to another country to donate or sell a kidney, but everything else is a lie. They don't know often exactly where, what part of the world they may go. They're lied to about how much money they will get. And when they get to a place and they start getting cold feet, they say, I want out, they can't get out. And in the most violent instances, the threats are physical. That is, that they have death threats against them. You can't leave unless you get up on that table and give a kidney. Then there's, in the softer version, it's all right, we'll let you out of this, but you now owe us $30,000.
So people feel trapped, and we're talking about people who are very low income generally.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sprinkling of, you know, poor university students who are looking to pay debts in some parts of the world. But by and large, it's been very predictable as to who the sellers are. They're people living in urban slums. They're people living in refugee camps. There are people, believe it or not, in mental hospitals. There are people who are rural agricultural laborers with no work. They're slum dwellers. They're favela dwellers. They're, I call them the wretched of the earth.
So how much, Nancy, does a kidney cost on the market?
Oh, depends on the country. It's not like, you know, it's not like coffee and sugar and other commodities and gold and silver. Although I sometimes call it the blood diamond of the transplant world. The poorer the country, the lower you're paid. In Moldova, people and Romania were being paid $2,000 to $3,000. In India, they could be paid as low as $1,000 or $2,000. Today, there's a little bit more equity going on, and I'd say that the average price going now is between $10,000 and $20,000.
Nancy Schaefer-Hughes is an anthropologist, and she's chair of the doctoral program in medical anthropology at UC Berkeley. She's also director of Organs Watch. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the global international black market in human organs.
Well, I don't like to call it black market in organs. It's black market in people. Because, you know, even though part of my work concerns what happens to the deceased and the, you know, also people who are in compromised situations and may or may not be brain dead and also, you know, tissue harvesting and all of that. But my primary concern is really with human trafficking of people with the intent of removing their kidney. So if you talk about black market in organs, you erase the people who are being trafficked. And I think that's been one of the problems in terms of our very weak prosecution in the United States of this activity, because they don't get the prosecutors in the United States that this is an issue about human trafficking. But anyway, just a correction that I think we have to start using the language that's appropriate to the crime.
Can you just talk, though, about what you see as the culpability of the medical establishment in this black market?
Yeah, I know. I've been criticized, you know, in the recent profile by author Ethan Waters about having in strong animus towards the surgeons that are involved in these operations, and or worse, that I have an animus towards transplant surgery. I don't. I'm opposed to the criminalization of transplant, and somehow I don't think my profiler understood enough that my anger was at doctors who were surgeons and their assistants, nephrologists and others, who lost their moral balance, you might say, and decided that, you know, every transplant is a good transplant, and we're not going to pay much attention as to where the donor came from, and I'm talking about the United States, you know, but of course I've worked in many other countries. But I was very, very disappointed in the number of surgeons that and hospitals and prestigious hospitals that became involved in this international syndicate, and how they just decided that they didn't want to know, didn't care to know. Because in the hospitals that I actually visited and addressed the surgeons and the teams, and there were many of these hospitals that I gave talks and, you know, said, look, you've got a problem here because people are being brought in. You don't know if they've been coerced. So that's what gets obscured. So I think I have a right to be upset at surgeons who are not paying attention and who know very well that the person is a foreigner and they have not really done their job, which they are supposed to by law, to really interview those people and find out if they want to change their mind.
More information about Nancy Schaefer-Hughes' investigation into organ trade at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents, and now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco's StoryCorps. From time to time, the StoryCorps team goes mobile and collects interviews at different sites around the Bay Area. One of the places they visited was Highland Hospital in East Oakland. The public hospital has been around since 1927, and in that time, it's served thousands of patients from all walks of life. Janae Harper goes by the nickname Z, and she's a patient care navigator at Highland. She helps her patients navigate the ups and downs of the healthcare system and get the treatment they need. Harper met Benica Curry at the hospital when Curry discovered she had stage 2 breast cancer.
I discovered my lump doing self-exam on myself July 15, 2012. That's my birthday. The urban community, you're so scared because you're not working. Your husband is the only one working, so you don't want to add to the bills. And I waited 7 months to even go to Highland Hospital, which to me, I think I would have been in stage zero instead of stage two. But it was so painful and I felt it growing. And so what Z did for me is to help me understand that it's that it'll be okay and that whatever I need, she got me. And she helped me feel not to feel like I was a burden on my husband, because now that I was trying to find a job, I got breast cancer, I can't work. So Z, what made you want to be a patient care navigator?
I never chose to be a patient care navigator. Actually, I hated hospitals. But then the recession came. I got laid off of my job for 15 years. Prior to this, I worked for a nationally recognized nonprofit. And, you know, basically it was economics. There was a job opening I thought I was qualified for, and I applied for it. But little did I know the privilege it is to work for a hospital. I always thought about sickness in regards to a hospital. I never thought about healing. I never thought about wellness. I never thought about any of it. So I feel like I'm being enlightened and educated. And I have to say that I feel blessed, especially blessed to work for Highland, because I'm an Oakland native. I'm 50 years old. And I'm born and raised here at Highland. So I really feel like I'm serving my community. So it's more than a job to me. You know, I personally believe there are professions and there are callings. And I believe that I have been called to serve. Highland used to have a reputation of just being a little raggedy ghetto hospital. And I'm not going to lie, initially, I kind of thought the same thing about Highland before I started working here and really getting to see the commitment that the employees have. I thought the same thing, honey. I thought I was cute. I was a Kaiser patient and, ooh, I'm not going to Highland. Are you kidding me? And now I feel so stupid and elitist because I was completely ignorant. But now I'm like, God is so good. God is so good. And he showed me the error of my ways. And I feel like because of that, ooh, I don't want to cry because I don't want to mess up my mascara. But now I feel like, man, how many people have I walked by on the street and judged them? You know, not knowing the backstory. Probably one of the greatest benefits of working here is it keeps me humble and it keeps me thankful because I see every day how blessed I truly am. And it just makes me that much more determined to be a blessing to somebody else. Patients aren't going to come to chemotherapy and they're trying to keep a roof over their head, or they're trying to put food in their stomach, or they have daycare issues. It was just amazing how the order of what's important in the medical field didn't match the order of what's important in your personal life. So through our program, we've been really able to kind of like reprioritize what's really important for the patient in their personal life in order to deal with their health issues. And I'm telling you, Benika, you put a lot of us to shame that actually have this as a job. The way you researched everything, I mean, I could just sit up here and give a testimonial about you all day. I feel so small in your presence because I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, it was rough for me, like, I guess because the way my hair was falling out. But then I promised myself that every time I go to chemo, I'm going to be dressed for success, you know, because that's an accomplishment. Going to this chemo, just trying to steal feel like you're human.
You know, some people are coming from, you know, being drug addicted or abusive relationships or just being poverty stricken. They don't really have a will to live. To them, it's like, this is just one more thing.
What I used to say, because that's how I felt, but what I realized is because you are damaged don't mean you cannot be loved.
That's right.
And you have to surround yourself at home, at your hospitals, as far as picking your doctors, mm-hmm. but especially at home, you have to surround yourself by positive people who are going to support you. Mm-hmm. And so my breast cancer journey has been awesome, especially having you in my corner. I'm the boxer and you my boxing coach.
Oh, well, go ahead.
And we fighting it.
I love you, Benika, and you're such a blessing to me. I, like I said, I'm better because of you.
That interview originally aired in October 2013. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW, or you can give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of your support, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Sandhya Dirks, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Marlo McKenzie, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Leela Day. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by San Francisco musician Beth Marlin. She's hosting an evening of talk and music tomorrow night, joined by Quillis and Cloud at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco. The evening starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
We always sit inside when she delivers his guacamole. His eyes get wide. Now I know I've got reason to be suspicious. He's in love with the waitress from Taco-licious. Yeah, she's hot and half my age. Make